thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
Episode 106, Back to the Future of Digital Humanities.
Hello and welcome to the Back from Summer edition of Digital Campus. This is episode 106 and we are recording on September the 12th, 2014. I am Stephen Robertson. I'm starting my second year as the director of the Rosenzweig Centre for History and New Media. And in honour of that, I'm finally stepping up to host a Digital Campus podcast. I spent my summer here at the centre, where it was the summer of training. We had groups of art historians funded by the Getty Institute, historians funded by the NEH coming through and becoming excited about the possibilities of the digital, thanks to Sharon Leon and Sheila Brennan and a very impressive crew of our graduate students. And then just to top it all off, Sharon and I went down to Millsaps College in Jackson to get their history department excited about digital humanities. I'm joined here by our regular crew, Mills Kelly. What was your summer like?
I had a summer of travel. It was for the first time in 15 years that I wasn't either teaching summer school or doing administrative or grant work. And so since I'm on a 9-month contract and don't get paid in the summers, I took the summer and traveled. It was pretty awesome.
And pretty much the opposite of me, who was here as a 12-month kind of experience for the first time. What about you, Dan Cohen? What was your summer about? Dan? We've lost Dan.
Okay. Oh, we have lost Dan.
All right. Okay, well, let's just try and keep going without him. So let's go to you. So, Tom, what was your summer like?
I had a good summer. Doesn't sound like it was as good as Mills's. It was my first summer on a 9-month contract. So that was a sort of a new experience. I did what I do sort of every summer, though. I wrote a bunch of grant proposals, but exciting stuff. So that's, it's always nice to put things out there, sort of throw bread upon the waters and see what comes back.
Indeed it was. And what about you, Dan Cohen? What was your summer like?
It was quite lovely. I actually got away up to Canada with my family, which was rather nice, and spoke a little French, ate some good food. So it was a very pleasant summer here in the Northeast.
That sounds great. And Amanda French, now down in Charlottesville, what was your summer about?
Yes, well, let's see. In the beginning of May, I went to Europe, which is not quite as fun as it sounds because I was working. I did a couple of book sprints, which is sort of an outgrowth of the back camp work. It was something I got really interested in. You take a week, you write a book collaboratively. So I got sort of shut up in a house in Stratford-upon-Avon for 1 week and, learned about how that works, and then got shut up in a house on the outskirts of Berlin for another week and wrote a different book that sort of, it was quite short, that one, only about like 40 pages, about book sprints. So it was quite interesting. And then I had a big grant writing project myself, which hopefully there will be some news about quite soon. So I did some grant writing on spec, and then I ran for 2 weeks a digital humanities summer faculty workshop at Northwestern University, which is so great. I really love doing that. It's the second time I've done it, and it's kind of like the book sprint. You never get this sort of dedicated time to do this kind of stuff. Northwestern, provides a lot of great staff, librarians and multimedia specialists and so on, and you work with 5 or 6 faculty on projects that they've come up with and moving them closer toward realizing them. So I was facilitating that and it was terrific. And so since then I've just been kicking back in Charlottesville.
Summer of all sorts and all kinds. We've got two more people in the podcast here, actually in my office with me at the center. As usual, we've got a producing team of our digital history fellows, Anne McDevitt, who's a second year fellow, and Alyssa Faringer, who's our one of our new first year fellows, who will be, and you'll see the other two in upcoming podcasts. All right, so this is the end of summer. We've talked about summer. We're now back to school, and we'll kick off the podcast by going around the horn and hearing what people think is going to be important trends moving forward in digital humanities in the coming year. And I'll throw that first to you, Mills. What is this year going to mean for us in terms of digital things?
Well, I'm not sure this is so much digital humanities as it falls more into the realm of ed tech. I'm spending the year this year actually in the presidential suite here at Mason as the presidential fellow. And so I get to sit in on all kinds of meetings and find out kind of what's going on all around campus. It's kind of like getting to be incredibly nosy. I was in a meeting last week where our ed tech people came back and reported all the stuff that they had learned during the summer, where things were going. And it was kind of interesting to me because the focus seems to have shifted from how do we present information to students or have them present it to us to how do we create the kinds of platforms that allow not only in-class collaboration through digital means, but also connecting to students who may not be in the classroom either synchronously or asynchronously. So there are a whole series of these kinds of things that they showed, sort of did a dog and pony show about, including sort of the small version of the smart board. It's instead of a flip chart, you know, on the tripod, it's a digital flip chart, and which anybody in the room can connect to with their phone and or their iPad or whatever. And you know, a lot of interest in lecture capture. I'll admit I'm so uninterested in capturing lectures that I was trying to not yawn, but just because lecturers, I think, well, you know, everybody who's listened to this before knows what I think about lecturing, but nevertheless, lots of people lecture and capturing those, okay, fine. There are lots of other kinds of in-class collaboration tools, all of them wireless at last, and so, but you know, wired if you want, but wireless is a possibility. And I can remember just 2 years ago being told, there's no chance that we can have Bluetooth-enabled projectors in our classrooms. No chance. Mm. And my response to that was, my children's middle school has that. Why can't a university have that? Oh, it's too complicated. There are all these protocols, blah, 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 blah. I mean, 1,000 reasons why that wasn't possible. But now all of a sudden, it's not just Bluetooth enabled and all sorts of other ways of things being enabled, but yeah, sure, we'll just use your, you know, you can now just, students can just pull up their phones and, like, you know, start changing what's on the board through you know, either using their finger or a stylus on their phones. So that's really shifted in the couple of years that I've been arguing with people about this here on campus. I think it's interesting to me how that enabling of smart devices in the classroom, whether they're laptops or tablets or phones, by the ed tech people, is running up against the "you will not open your laptop in my classroom" from faculty members, which still seems to gain a little bit of traction every year. Certainly, we see news stories about, you know, I don't let my students email me, I don't let them use laptops in the classroom, that kind of thing. So, the culture clash on campus around technology in the classroom, I think, is going to be a really interesting one to watch, because universities are going to be investing an awful lot of money, and not necessarily for good results, but they're going to be investing a lot of money in these kinds of trendy collaboration technologies, many of which are coming directly out of what's already happening in industry. And so just getting kind of repurposed for the educational space. But what does that mean in terms of culture clash in the classroom? Well, I think that's going to be an interesting story as we go forward.
Tom, have you got ed tech culture clashes brewing up in Connecticut?
It's interesting. One of the things I'd like to ask Mills is, in your in your position in the president's office, and one thing I've heard around campus here is that, you know, our administration, it seems, one of the gripes I hear about it is that there's a lot of willingness to invest in, you know, new kit, these new smart boards and these new Bluetooth enabled devices, and not a lot of interest in investing in people to do the training and to help the students and to train the students how to use them and the professors how to use them, and to even develop in-house tools to be able to make best use of them for the particular population that's here at UConn. Is that part of the kind of discussion there at George Mason too?
Yeah, it is part of the discussion, and it's, you know, it's a fraught part of the discussion because we just had to take a huge budget cut from the state because the state of Virginia's budget is in the hole like $4 billion. And so every state agency, us included, is having to give back out of the current fiscal year. I think our give back is like $21 million or something like that, which you can't make up by, you know, turning off the lights in classrooms when nobody's using them. You can only make up that kind of money by removing salary and benefits from the payroll, which means firing people. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a big issue because I'll give you a very specific statistic about why it's an issue. So here at George Mason, we have in almost all of our quote unquote smart classrooms have a document projector, an Elmo or whatever they're called these days. And these are pretty cool devices. If you've never used one, you know, it's like the concept of the old overhead projector, you know, except you don't need a transparency. You can just lay a book down or a photo or whatever, and everybody can see it. You can press a button and capture it and post that to your website if you're using Blackboard. And so, you know, it's a nice device. And they cost about $3,000 each,
right,
to purchase. And then there's the maintenance contract that goes with them, which I don't know how much that costs, but it's certainly in the hundreds of dollars per year per device. And so the nice thing about those is because they're connected to the central IT system, is that the IT people can monitor how often they are used. Huh. And the answer is 11% use rate. Something like 9% of our faculty actually use those, probably 8%, I don't know, something less than 11% of the total number of people probably use those devices. And you know, so when somebody asked me about budget cuts, I said, well, we should get rid of 3/4 of those document cameras right away, you know, sell them on eBay or something, because we're not using them.
Right.
And so, but yeah, we've installed them. And the response to that was, oh, but you know, we never know which faculty members are going to be in which classroom. To which I said, so we're going to install maximum tech in every classroom for the few people who want to use them.
Right. Well, right. And that money is that, you know, the money that's spent on equipment is, you know, it goes straight out the door to the vendor.
Right.
Exactly. It's not reinvested back in the university.
Right. So my, you know, I bring that example up because I think that, if there were, you know, if there was sort of a conscious effort to engage faculty around how to use various kinds of technologies, the use rates would go up.
Right.
And you know, would it go? It certainly would be more than 11%. And this is not to say that our IT people don't try, you know, because they do.
They
really try to engage faculty around this, but faculty look at some of this stuff in the classroom and probably wonder, I wonder how I could use that, or is that just like an overhead projector, but you don't need a transparency? Well, I don't use overheads, so I guess I won't use that. Lots of people probably don't know that you can capture an image of what's there and post it straight out to your website. You know, So there's work to be done around that, and as you suggest, Tom, it's about human capital.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, humans and machines, not just technology.
And if I could just throw in one other thing, this is where people hate for me to be in these conversations, since I pointed out we were in a brand new building here on campus. I mean, it's like 2 years old when we were having this meeting, and I just pointed out. I said, let's just take a moment and count the number of wall plugs in this room, which is also used as a classroom. There were two, so a total of 4 plugs in a classroom, or.
Yeah, which is why we all carry our power boards with us. Amanda, what do you see coming up in EdTech?
Well, I guess I wanted to back up for a minute and just say something that I've been noticing recently. I've been, you know, talking to a number of people who are not in the digital humanities and maybe even aren't on the fringes. Of course, I always have because of going to all the that camps and so on. But what has really struck me recently is how many people collapse the distinction that you just very carefully made, Mills, between digital humanities and ed tech. You know, I get when I tell people who are sort of aware of the phrase that I do digital humanities, they're like, oh, so you know all about MOOCs. I was like, well, no, that's kind of a different thing, you know, although I feel that, you know, digital humanists certainly have taken a role in critiquing some of educational technology and new forms of online education, but it, you know, all of that came from elsewhere, you know, and some digital humanists are experimenting with, you know, forms of online education, certainly with educational technology. So they're related but not identical fields of endeavor, and that's just one of the things that I've been noticing. Because for me, digital humanities was always very much about the research part. You know, it was research methods. And research, you know, scholarly communication and that kind of thing. And so it's obviously related to teaching, but not identical with it. So I just wanted to say that I've been noticing more and more recently that anytime you mention anything to do with computers, people think that that's the domain of the digital humanities. But no, in terms of coming up, I mean, I did notice that Google launched a new course management platform. I haven't played with it at all, I read a little bit about it from Audrey Waters, who's my go-to person for that kind of thing. And yeah, other than that, I'm very much out of the back-to-school rhythm these days, so I don't know what's going on.
What about you, Dan? Do you still have any back-to-school rhythm going on?
It is also starting to disappear from my brain at this point, having been a year out of the academy now. But now that in Boston the leaves are just starting to turn, I guess I am naturally feeling that September excitement and fear that comes with academia. You know, one interesting note from my end on the ed tech side, I was at a meeting recently where there were a number of people from edX, the sort of open MOOC platform that Harvard and MIT have put together. And I think while Amanda's right, there's been in some cases, unfortunate collapse between the MOOC world and the digital humanities world. There's been some conflation there. What I was hearing from those edX folks is that, for instance, they are really intrigued by Omeka exhibits that we're putting together as essentially ready to go modules, learning modules, topical kinds of units to put into something in an edX environment. And so they're actually now looking at ways to kind of bring more of these resources in. And certainly from the Digital Public Library of America side, you know, we'd be perfectly happy to have a lot of our content flow seamlessly through our API into edX or any of these other environments. So I think that we'll be seeing a little bit more of that pull happening. And to me, that's you know, not necessarily a bad development, but I think Amanda's absolutely right that I think we've focused on the research outcomes, you know, what can these new exhibits or methods enable? And I think from the MOOC side, they're really viewing it still, as we've discussed on this podcast before, they're still viewing it very traditionally as a kind of, you know, just straight up library resource, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's fantastic. But it does, in some sense, ignore some of the I think new methodology and certainly, you know, as historians, let's say the historiography that goes into some of the additional features that we'd want to add into something like Omeka.
Well, the way that has always, the digital humanities pedagogy for me has always, you know, it's always been something that's around and people talk about it, but where I've seen it, what I've seen happen is that it overlaps with this whole trend in undergraduate education toward an emphasis on undergraduate research, right? So, which is exactly the opposite of sitting in a lecture hall being lectured to. And at Northwestern in particular, the two-week workshop that I ran was funded by the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation as part of their emphasis on undergraduate research. So there's you know, so the projects that faculty were proposing had to have a particular role for undergraduates in them. So in fact, some of the projects that they were proposing were new kinds of courses where the students would be themselves doing research intensive projects that would, instead of embodying themselves in just an essay form, you know, become something like an Omeka exhibit or a Scalar exhibit or something like that. So, and that's what the digital humanists I know have always been really, really interested in. And oddly enough, you know, it's something that I think it would be just really difficult to do online. You know, you do it in the classroom because it takes a lot of sort of individual tutelage and support to get students working either on a group project or on individual projects to themselves, you know, do the kind of research that digital humanists do and present it in the way that digital humanists do. So
it is really an interesting kind of paradox. I mean, here in my new department in digital media and design, we're training students how to become producers of digital content and digital resources. And you know, the administration hears digital, and of course they are, you know, extremely keen to hook us up with our eCampus, you know, online education folks and make sure that, you know, that like and offer our programs online. And it is sort of one of the strange things where it's actually very difficult to teach the digital skills in the online environment. I mean, it sounds like it should be something you do there, but in fact, it's actually not something you can do effectively outside of the classroom. So that's kind of an interesting, and I don't know whether that's different from computer science, which I think has, I mean, at least that was the first place where a lot of these big MOOCs, it was their entry point. So maybe you can teach computer science and code, but I think digital media approaches, digital humanities approaches are not something that are kind of readily teachable in the online environment.
And I guess the one thing I'd throw out here, which is not really strictly speaking, I guess, ed tech, but in terms of actually getting students in a teaching environment to be able to do their own research projects, the one change that I'm making in my teaching this semester, and I'm teaching Clio 1, our graduate introduction to digital history, and I'm taking this from the Summer Institutes, is for the first time, all of the students in that class, courtesy of Reclaim Hosting, will have their own domains. You know, and this is our introductory class, so this is something that the students are going to have basically from the moment they begin their graduate training. And we worked a lot with the Reclaim folk in the Summer Institute. They've made it absurdly easy for people to set up and manage their domains, and with one-click WordPress installs, and particularly of interest to us, one-click Omeka installs. You know, and students in the Clio sequence have ended up with domains often by the time they get to Clio 2, but it's now become so ridiculously easy to set your students up, and therefore to set them up in environments where they can do digital humanities projects, that I think it's I'd give that shout out to Reclaim. I think that the domain of their own, I think, is something our students really should be having from the day they arrive on campus. And I think that would, in some ways, potentially bridge some of these gaps between classrooms and digital humanities research. All right, time to move on to another topic. A lot of what I was reading over the summer had to do in some way or another with Twitter. And the state of Twitter and the size of Twitter and the consequences of being on Twitter and the relationships for academics between Twitter and their other kinds of digital identities and their broader scholarly identities. And I guess rather than plucking one of those particular strands out, the question that I'm really curious about is there fire underneath the smoke? Is Twitter changing? Is it posing new questions for the kinds of scholarly identities that academics and others should have, and the part that Twitter should play in them? Who wants the first stab at that?
Oh, well, I'd love to jump in, Stephen, with my little tale of questions from the summer. So I think it then is a good lead into, you know, discussing what you just mentioned of sort of being a public, I guess, as a scholar and what it means to be on Twitter. So a couple months ago on Twitter, I started receiving dozens of questions a day about history of all kinds in areas I don't even know about, like 15th century China and ancient Rome. And I really could not figure out why I was getting these questions. I just assumed it was a form of Twitter spam. And I, you know, kept blocking people and found it increasingly, frankly, hard to be on Twitter because of how many at replies I was getting with these historical questions. And it took a while, but then the questions started appearing with links to answers.com, where I was supposed to answer these questions. And John Overholt, who is a librarian, a rare book librarian at Harvard, finally figured out that answers.com was adding my Twitter account to every single one of their history pages. And this is like a wiki type environment. So there were literally thousands of pages where it would say, you know, talk about absolutism and French kings. And then halfway down the page, it would say, hey, why don't you ask a question about absolutism to Dan Cohen over here? And so this is a wonderful
development. Dan has all the answers.
Exactly. So so my jaw dropped when John let me know about this. He said, you know, do you know that like it actually says tweet a question to Dan Cohen all over answers.com? And I looked and I couldn't believe it. And so I, you know, I was rather unhappy about this and started to, you know, find ways to block them. First, and you know, this is really not something that like a regular user could do. And it's not that I'm such a sophisticated user, but I do use a client, not the website, which is not true for most people. 90% of the people use the Twitter website, so you couldn't do this. But using a client, I actually started blocking a certain part of the API that lists the client that's used by the person submitting a tweet. And it turns out they were using a very specific signature on these tweets that came from answers.com. So I blocked that whole thing, which then did silence the people because it was all different people. You couldn't just you know, label something as spam. It was happening from thousands of different people tweeting at me all at once. So I did that for a while and, you know, wrote to them, got no response, wrote to Twitter, got no response, you know, saying filed a like abusive use of Twitter's API sort of thing. And not really nothing worked until I finally got through to the head of marketing, frankly, only through someone else who follows me on Twitter who happened to know someone there. And they finally turned off these buttons, these tweet to Dan buttons all over their site. But it really did underline for me what I think has been a kind of growing negativity on Twitter about, which I guess happens in all of these online environments. I think it happened to Usenet, for instance, the Usenet user groups and discussion groups in the late 80s, early 90s, when just a flood of people came into them. And it just... at some point, it just becomes like there's so many people and there's so many bad actors that bad things happen. So I think that, along with some of the changes that Twitter has talked about making, like reordering the timeline and maybe leaving out some tweets, make me something of a Twitter skeptic going into the fall.
Do we have other Twitter skeptics going into the fall?
Me, a Twitter skeptic?
You joined, Mills. You have no ground to stand on. You did actually join it.
I have nothing to point to that's sort of as dramatic as Dan's situation, which, you know, I watched from afar and like in horror, and I'm glad it's resolved. But I feel like Twitter has become less useful for me, and it's just sort of a vague feeling, and I've spent a lot less time there than I did in previous years. And in fact, when I am on there, I've noticed that the rest of you have spent less time, are spending less time on there. So maybe that's partly my dissatisfaction with the experience, is that all of my friends are dissatisfied as well and are leaving. But I do sense that that something has in the past, I don't know, 12 months, 18 months, shifted, where it has become, as Dan says, so big, and the community has become so diverse that using it for a kind of very specific purpose, which I, and I think all of us did, which is to connect with like-minded scholars, to use it for a kind of specific purpose rather than a kind of general, you know, tweeting out photos of your kids kind of purpose, it has lost some of its usefulness there.
What about you, Amanda? Are you still seeing Twitter as useful?
I'm using Twitter in a different way than I used to, and I think a bit less. I actually, for a while, I've had an off and on scholarly interest in Twitter. I think many people do. My specific interest was always in artistic uses of Twitter. In the early days of Twitter, the good old days of Twitter, in addition to sort of really forming a digital humanities community in a way, I was always interested in the parody accounts and the hashtag games and the poetry accounts and, you know, all of the different ways in which people were using the platform to do art. People would do real-time dramas kind of a thing. They, in fact, I think in 2009, they did the, they reenacted the moon landing on the 40th anniversary. And people seem to be using Twitter a lot less creatively than they used to. So I've always been kind of interested in that. And then at the same time, I still find Twitter useful. And I still find that I can use it in some of the ways that I was using it, which is, you know, sort of almost as an RSS reader. Mm-hmm. I do still get a lot of my news from Twitter and so on. And I still, you know, keep up with what people are doing. And I still think it's better than Facebook for the, you know, for the sort of professional community building types of purposes that I want to use it for. But I've had... I've had to block people. Actually, let me take responsibility for this. I've chosen to block people on Twitter, which is not to say that that I haven't actually, I think, benefited from, you know, the expansion of the community on Twitter. I think
that's
I have.
Why I'm not seeing you on Twitter, Amanda. You've blocked.
You better watch it, Tom. You could get blocked quite easily. But yeah, I've chosen to block a few people, and that has worked for me. I think there's always a real difficulty with. I think it's one reason why there's always room for new social media. Weirdly enough, I mean, a lot of people are using things like Medium or, you know, Tumblr or Instagram or Google Plus. You know, there are new social media networks that spring up all the time, and I think this is one of the reasons. You know, that it's partly the affordances of the technology and the decisions made by the company that runs the technology, you know, like such as whether to reorder tweets and, you know, thread conversations and things like that, filter things. But it's partly just that, you know, there's such a thing as a Dunbar number, you know, the 150 people that you can manage to have in your community. And once that gets too large, it may be just time to go off into other spaces, but I'm suspicious of that deep desire in myself to only talk to like-minded people. It is a very deep desire, and it is something I very much enjoy, talking to like-minded people. But I do think that digital humanities, particularly in the last couple of years, has achieved a kind of real success, and then also patina of success that I never thought it would. And so that has led to certain conversations that I never imagined having. And that's probably a good thing. So.
Do you want to voice any skepticism, Mills, other than the ones you're well known for?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think I'm probably more like Amanda in the sense, because of course, nobody's ever going to put a tweet to Mills button on answers.com. So Dan, I just want you to know, I was tempted to ask a couple of questions too, but I could just put myself in your shoes.
Don't make me block you.
That's right. That's right. So, but I could also, you know, I'm really sympathetic. I like Tom, I was watching some of that, just thinking like, oh man, I'm so glad that's not me. But, and so glad that I will never be that popular. So the but I'm like Amanda. I mean, there, if you know, for me, actually, here's the big use for Twitter, is that there are lots of people who I wouldn't know what they were up to otherwise, up to in a scholarly way otherwise. And, you know, and most of these people are in Europe or, you know, in other countries, really. So I wouldn't run into them at conferences and here in the U.S. And so that for me, it's the internationalization aspect that's useful. You know, I've learned a lot about what other people are doing in other countries through Twitter. But, you know, if Tumblr had better audience controls, I would probably dump Twitter and go straight to Tumblr because I like it a lot better. But it's still a little bit for the professional space, it's still a little too much of the Wild West for me. You know, I feel the pull of this other network. So I'm going to just agree with Amanda here and say, you know, I do feel this pull of other kinds of, or maybe I'm just one of those people she was talking about, feeling the pull of other social networks. And I just like Tumblr a lot more. But it's a little, like I say, it's a little too much of the Wild West as a place where I'm going to do anything professionally.
Well, it's interesting to me that, I mean, so there is actually a connection, which may not be obvious, between Dan's experience of getting spammed by Answers.com and all of this, which is, you know, the way Twitter architected itself was all originally, at least, it's increasingly less so, but it was originally very open, right? So it had a great API, and it had sort of modular things that you could incorporate into the entire network of the web, right? So that's one of the reasons it became very successful, is you could take tweets and, you know, put them in a feed on CNN, or you could create art from them, and you could you know, program devices to do particular things and interact with Twitter. Mark Sample still does a lot of great Twitter bots, which is still, you know, he's doing some great art/scholarship that way. But that very openness of the network also means that it's open to everyone. It really is, you know, a global platform. And despite the fact that it's a global platform, people do create their own little birds of a feather networks. And it's just always interesting to me as a humanities question, you know, whether it's not good for us to see other perspectives, and how much of other perspectives can we actually see, you know? So I have certain like feeds that are, some people think that Twitter is all about like celebrities and celebrity news, and that's what they use it for. There's a really interesting study going on, which actually ran into a little bit of controversy recently, about what they call Black Twitter, right? That because Twitter is so easily usable on mobile phones, it has had a big uptake in sort of disadvantaged communities, and there's this whole, you know, structure of quote unquote Black Twitter that was, you know, really instrumental in getting Ferguson into the mainstream news. And even just, there's a graduate student that I follow on Twitter who is amazing, and I hope he's doing well finishing his dissertation and gets an amazing job, Matt Thomas. And he was in the news last year for retweeting a bunch of things on the search My Professor. So he would do a search on My Professor with various keywords and retweet all these things that undergraduates were saying about their professors. And it was sort of shocking and amusing and wonderful because, you know, how often do you really even try to learn what your students are saying about you or what students are saying about professors in a real way? So it's this exposure to new perspectives, which again is kind of supposed to be what reading novels is about, right? I'm a literary scholar, you know, with all of you historians, and that's what it's supposed to be about. So Twitter has that potential in it, and yet, you know, I prefer to talk with people who share my perspective, you know? So it's almost a moral issue for me, you know, that I find it important to stay on Twitter in order to get exposed to new perspectives that I might not otherwise be exposed to.
I mean, I guess I'm probably the newest the last person in this group to go onto Twitter, because I really wasn't in Australia for complicated reasons that maybe have to do with Mills's point about internationalization, which, you know, Twitter as an academic tool has appeared differently in different places. And as a latecomer, there is that I think there is that real tension for me around the possibilities of connecting with a whole cross section of people on Twitter, and the extent to which that's an opportunity to engage with people who are not necessarily like-minded, and then just the stream that that represents. And I'm happy to confess to unfollowing people at certain points where I just no longer have the capacity to absorb some of those different kinds of positions. And I think that maybe there really is, a different dimension to big Twitter, in the sense that I think there is an increasing fragmentation going on even within big Twitter. And I think that there are a lot of birds of the feather community out there on different sides of debates and representing different aspects of the digital humanities community, and that they intersect, I think, perhaps spasmodically, and people are coming in and out of Twitter at various points. Steve Ramsey, notably last year, disappeared from Twitter to reappear. And even as someone with a limited lifespan on Twitter, I have a lot of empathy for that sense that the continuous flow of what is going on out there is something that I can't always handle all the time. And I wonder whether that's part of what's going on. And I'm certainly an RSS feeder substitute. For me, Twitter is my RSS feeder substitute. I rely on it a lot to track what's going on. And in terms of shifting platforms, part of what I'm kind of curious about there is the extent to which some people seem to be returning to blogs as part of their response to what's going on in Twitter, and as part of the response that we touched on a bit last year, in the new, at least, buzz around long-form writing, and that maybe it's not just a move on always to new platforms, but maybe a circling back to other platforms that seem to have a different use in a different context.
Yeah, that's a great point, Stephen. I think the rebirth of blogs is certainly something that we've heard about in the past couple of months. There's actually some new platforms, one just launched this week called Known, that's sort of just a super simple blogging platform that also has a kind of Twitter component to it. It's gotten a lot of buzz. Ghost also launched this year, which is a similar sort of thing, like for people who find WordPress too involved, which it really is. I mean, its dashboard is rather extensive and has a lot of features that just someone who wants to write would like to get past Medium, which is a commercial entity. Evidently I haven't used it, but also has sort of an easy to write in environment that a lot of people found attractive. What I miss is, back to Amanda's good point, is that, and you pointed it out as well, Stephen, is the connection to other communities. And if I were to drop off Twitter, I'd be concerned about that. I was actually just at a meeting in Kansas City that included a lot of data journalists. And I think they're doing work that really overlaps almost wholly with the work that's done in digital humanities. They're thinking about large-scale document storage and text mining. They're doing new forms of crowdsourcing and communities. They're doing all the kinds of things that I think we need to hear about. And I really connected with all those people first on Twitter, and then was able to go to a conference where they were all there in person. I'm not sure without that sort of hyper-caffeinated free flow, answers.com be damned. Without that, I'm not sure how I would actually connect with those people, because I probably wouldn't find their blogs just naturally.
Right. And on a personal level, I am all in favor of, managing one's time spent on social media, and the same is true for email, the same is true for, internet surfing. I think that's that, in a weird way, that's an important digital skill to have.
Yep.
For the 21st century. But having it be there when you want it or need it, and taking a very conscious approach to the way you use it, I think is very key.
All right. Well, perhaps on the note that there is not always time to spend as much time to spend on things as you would like, we should bring this podcast to an end. Thank you, everybody, for coming back to school with us. Thank you for telling us all about your summers. As usual, we will do our best to continue to bring this podcast to everybody every 2 weeks, schedules permitting, but we've got a lot of schedules to manage, and that may not always be the case. But so thank you, everybody, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again in 2 weeks.
We have to fear is fear itself, fear itself, fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for you.